Good morning, Kansas City, and good morning, Iowa Public Radio. Normally, Iowans would be hearing host Charity Nebbe of Talk of Iowa, but today's program is part of what will be an ongoing collaboration with Harvest Public Media, a regional journalism initiative involving six NPR member stations in the Midwest, including Iowa Public Radio and our station here in Kansas City, KCUR. The program you're listening to right now is Central Standard, and I'm your host, Jabulani LaFall. Our subject of the day is ethanol, as ancient as it is modern, as lauded as it is derided. Some believe that ethanol fuel, derived from cultivated plants such as corn, wheat, barley, and sugarcane, is the big answer to the tough questions surrounding America's energy policy. Meanwhile, others see it as a fad evangelized by its heavily subsidized large farm owners, corporate supporters, and, of course, lobbyists. In the studio with me here is Harvest Public Media's executive supervisor and KCUR news director, Frank Morris. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Morning, Jabulani. How you doing?
And on the phone is Bruce Babcock, professor of economics and the director for the Center of Agricultural and Rural Development at Iowa State University. Professor Babcock, welcome to Central Standard.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And later on in the show, we'll have Kathleen Masterson of Harvest Public Media, who's also at Iowa Public Radio, and Jessica Najunas, a Harvest Public Media reporter out of KBIA in Columbia. Now, let's start with you, Frank. You're the executive supervisor of Harvest Public Media, as I mentioned. What is Harvest Public Media?
Well, it's a Midwestern public radio and TV collaborative, including our friends at Iowa Public Radio, as you mentioned, and Nebraska's Public Radio and TV Network, Kansas Public Radio, High Plains Public Radio, KBIA in Columbia, Missouri, and, of course, KCUR here in Kansas City. The interesting thing is that we're all centered around coverage of not a region but a topic, agriculture. And we're doing it for consumers really more than farmers. We've just got this rolling a few months ago, but we intend to develop into a go-to source for high-quality general interest news about American agriculture. We're making headway. We've already had two stories on NPR. We've got a three-part series running next week on Morning Edition. Our website's drawing hits from all over the world. And soon we'll have stories published on paper in the Kansas City Star. And we're getting inquiries from other potential media partners around the country.
And that's a good thing. Mr. Babcock, you were interviewed for some of those features, the upcoming feature that Frank just mentioned on Morning Edition. What do you think getting back to ethanol basics is important with a topic like ethanol? What's the origin of ethanol?
Well, the origin of ethanol, of course, is a drink that most of us enjoy occasionally, and that's actually the origin of ethanol. But from the get-go of internal combustion engines, everyone has known that you can drive cars fueled by ethanol. And so it's been around a long time. It's only been recently where the price of gasoline has risen enough to make it economical to start thinking about replacing some of that gasoline with ethanol.
It's kind of interesting, too, I think, to note that people like Henry Ford, who are big sort of rural boosters, really made a point of making these cars, flex fuel vehicles back at the turn of the last century, because they wanted to do just kind of what ethanol has wound up doing, and that is to shore up the rural economies.
And we're reminded of the old saying, you can start your car up with this. Now, when did it become in the serious discussion as a fuel additive?
Well, it really seriously became part of our fuel supply in the around 2004, 2005, when crude oil prices started rising. And also at about that time, the preferred oxygenate, or the preferred additive to gasoline that gave it octane, which was MTBE, started becoming falling out of favor because of problems with groundwater contamination of groundwater supplies. So higher crude oil prices combined with the phase out of MTBE really made the demand for ethanol explode in 2005, 2006, 2007. And so that's really when we've almost about tripled supply since then.
And ethanol has been on the rise ever since, as you mentioned. But everyone from former Vice President Al Gore to Fox News' Glenn Beck have questioned where ethanol fits into the energy equation. What's the science behind ethanol?
Well, the science behind ethanol is, ethanol is a fuel that can be used to substitute for gasoline. And the more efficient that you can produce that ethanol, the better it is in terms both of cost savings. You know, you can lower the cost of producing ethanol, but also in terms of how much greenhouse gas emissions you can reduce by burning ethanol because it's a renewable fuel, and how much energy that you save by burning ethanol. So the more efficient that you can make ethanol, the better the fuel is.
Professor Babcock, it seems like a simple enough proposition, but why isn't there a consensus in the scientific community about ethanol?
Well, there is consensus on certain areas in the scientific community. I think that if you poll almost any scientist about, for example, does it take more energy to produce ethanol than it gives back in terms of energy replacement of gasoline, you know, 95-98% of scientists will say, well, that's been settled a long time ago. Ethanol takes less energy to produce than it gives back in the gasoline supply. So the scientific community is settled on that issue. Where it's not settled on in terms of the science is that some people think that we're cutting down lots of Amazon rainforest to produce because of the land that is needed to produce ethanol, and so I think there's more scientific uncertainty about what is the net greenhouse gas reduction from burning ethanol instead of burning gasoline, and so I think that's where there's some scientific uncertainty.
All right, and speaking of which, what about this concept of externalized cost that sort of is juxtaposed to the emissions benefits of ethanol? It's ethanol is hard to transport, and right now producing it, the argument is that it expends more energy to produce it than ultimately the energy that's going to be saved.
Well, I think that the science has debunked that last question. It does not take more energy to produce than it saves. That is a scientifically settled question, and people that bring that up are just bringing out disinformation. And so that part is pretty well settled. The other part of how you incorporate ethanol into the fuel supply, it is a bit more difficult to transport. It's a little bit more costly to transport because you have to do it with dedicated rail cars rather than pipelines in the United States. But Brazil is really showing us the way about ethanol. They are quite successful at running their vehicle fleet on 100% ethanol, and so Brazil has shown that ethanol is a viable substitute for gasoline, and it's just in the United States, it's just a matter of how much do we want to replace gasoline with ethanol, at what price are we willing to pay for it? So I think those are the unsettled questions.
But you mentioned this unsettled question about the ecology with ethanol, and again, you know, it's a matter of what you take built into the equation, isn't it? I mean, if you how far you go in terms of counting environmental degradation, you know, maybe in Brazil, how do ethanol supporters parse this to come up with a big net gain in terms of CO2 emissions? And how does it fall the other way for folks who have come out against ethanol?
Yeah, so the ethanol supporters parse it that ethanol producers and corn producers shouldn't be liable for any indirect effects that are caused by the market price for corn for going up. So they parse it that they're not responsible for it, and because they're not responsible for it, ethanol reduces greenhouse gas emissions by about 50%. And I think that's probably true if you parse it that way. Anti-ethanol people parse it that it, of course, corn and ethanol plants should be responsible for any change in agricultural supply around the world because ethanol raises the price of corn. So it's almost a policy decision or philosophical decision as who's responsible for what. But I think you're exactly right, Frank. How you parse it determines what the final answer is going to be.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR and live streaming on KCUR.org in Kansas City. And part of a special show today on Iowa Public Radio. Normally, Iowans would be hearing the voice of Charity Nebbe on Talk of Iowa. But today, KCUR is collaborating with Iowa Public Radio in conjunction with Harvest Public Media to take a look at ethanol. And we've been talking ethanol with Professor Bruce Babcock. in Ames, Iowa. And in studio live with us is Harvest Public Media's Executive Supervisor, Frank Morris. Now, what does ethanol mean to you, callers? How green is it? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us with the hashtag HChat. If you have a question for our guests or a comment on ethanol and its place in the future of America, just hit us up, either by phone or by tweet. Now, extending ethanol subsidies for another year has become part of the tax bill debate recently. Frank, what's the update on that? Professor Babcock, you can chime in on this as well.
Yeah, please do, Professor Babcock. I mean, it's basically that the Senate has passed its one-year extension with 45 cent per gallon blending credit for ethanol and the tariff as well. So this would be about a $6 billion blending credit for blenders, mainly big oil companies who blend the ethanol in with the gasoline. They get a tax credit, and that's the cost, the direct cost of the subsidy to ethanol, and that's been extended for a year through the Senate. I don't think the House has taken that up yet. Is that right, Professor?
That's right. And as you say, that blending credit primarily goes to the oil companies, the blenders, who are obligated to blend a tremendous amount of ethanol already, because we also have a mandated use of ethanol in terms of a renewable fuel standard. So many people have asked the question, why do we need both tax credits and mandates? And the political process has spoken. I think we're going to have them both for another year.
But, Professor, you don't think that's necessary?
Well, it depends on what your objective is. If your objective is to, in some sense, subsidize the blenders for doing what they're obligated to do in terms of blending 12.6 billion gallons of gasoline next year, then they're not necessary. But if you really believe that they won't use that ethanol unless you subsidize them, then I think they are necessary, because it's really the taxpayer paying the cost of ethanol rather than the fuel pump or the blenders paying the cost of ethanol.
And Professor Babcock, what does the ethanol tax debate being tacked on to the tax bill debate say about ethanol's relevance today?
Well, what it says is that if Congress had to pass the tax credit alone as a standalone measure, it doesn't have enough support to do it. But because there are so many very strong supporters of they're not so many, but there's a few very strong supporters of ethanol, that when a must-pass piece of legislation passes, then they can tack that ethanol tax credit on, and it passes through Congress. And I think that's what we're seeing, that as a standalone measure, it doesn't have enough congressional support. But when it's supporters find ways of passing that along into big, important pieces of legislation.
Professor, I'm curious, though. You know, you've come down on the side of, you know, that this blending credit is not necessary. Well, what happens if you take the blending credit away? Does EPA really have the power to enforce this this mandate? Or, I mean, what happens to the industry absent the blending credit?
Well, EPA does have the power to enforce the mandate. The EPA regulates our gasoline supply. They are the agency that regulates what's in our gasoline supply, and they do have the power to enforce these mandates, and they have enforced these mandates. It's part of federal law that the blenders have got to blend 12.6 billion gallons of ethanol next year, rising to 13.2, then 13.8 billion gallons. Ethanol is going to be expanding in our gasoline supply over the next 2 to 3, 4 years, and so EPA does have that power.
What's the point of the credit then?
The point of the credit is that the ethanol industry has had this credit for a long time, and evidently they feel very strongly that they can't do without it. And there's a few reasons I can kind of see. Maybe they don't trust EPA in enforcing the mandates. Maybe they want the oil companies to be in favor of ethanol, so taxpayers have to subsidize oil companies in order to use it, or maybe they just don't believe economists who think they don't need them both. I don't know, but it's one of those three reasons.
A reoccurring theme in this show, and it'll come up in the discussion later in the hour, will be this trifecta of the tax credit, the tariff, and the mandate. So we'll definitely be talking about that. But right now we're going to go to Brian in Tipton, Iowa. Brian, welcome to Central Standard.
Well, thank you for taking my call. And I'm a skeptic when it comes to a lot of things. And there's a bad stigma about skepticism. Everyone thinks that it's just negative. And they're actually just asking questions. And I'm not a researcher, but I go off of the researchers of James Randi, Brian Dunning, Michael Shermer, and Penn and Teller. And I've listened to a lot of stuff on ethanol. And I go back and forth. But and they're all big parts of the science community. And they bring up a few points about ethanol. One, that your miles per gallon with ethanol is considerably lower. Two, you can't pipeline ethanol because water gets in it. And the amount per capita of ethanol produced is really inefficient compared to other crops, such as switchgrass and things like that. And that a lot of times there's no consideration taking the amount of energy put into the process from field to pump instead of just from pump to emission.
And that's that concept of externalized costs we were talking about. Professor Babcock, do you want to speak to what Brian from Tipton, Iowa is saying?
Well, with regards to starting at the last point, the life cycle analysis is really a whole analysis of energy use and greenhouse gas emissions from the field to the tailpipe. And in fact, it has been established beyond doubt that even accounting for lower miles per gallon, even accounting for the fact it can't move through a pipeline, that ethanol has a positive energy balance and it reduces greenhouse gas emissions. That is settled science. And the more we talk about it, the more we give credibility to those scientists who dispute it, because it's like climate change. I mean, if you ask people about, are humans going to contribute to climate change, 97% of scientists say yes, and the 3% say it's unsettled. Well, you know, I think there might be 1% of scientists who think this is unsettled. So this is settled science. Now, with regards to, is it more efficient? Are other feedstocks more efficient than corn? Undoubtedly, yes. Sugarcane ethanol in Brazil is far more efficient from both an energy balance and a greenhouse gas emissions. If we can ever figure out how to take switchgrass, miscanthus, corn stover, cellulosic material, and produce biofuels out of that, the science has shown that that is even more efficient than sugarcane ethanol. So there are more efficient feedstocks out there. However, we don't know how to economically put them into our fuel supply yet. And we're working on that, but that simply is not economical, where for corn ethanol and for sugarcane ethanol, those two feedstocks, it's economical to do it. So I think that the caller is right on the money with some concerns, but the scientists have taken those into account over the last 15 years, and it's settled science now.
And Professor Babcock, you hear this a lot. Well, you know, we should be using switchgrass or some other material, some way to get ethanol out of cellulose. But that is very that's tricky, and it's been 5 years out, as Professor Swenson, your colleague there, says in Iowa State University, it's been 5 years out forever, and it's still 5 years out because it's so difficult to get energy out of the material that really binds plants together, and then you've got these other issues that people don't take into account often in terms of transporting bulky hay like stuff, and then also getting the financing in place to build an industry is sort of that would be mirror the corn ethanol industry. Very, very, very taxing and more difficult than most people realize.
And that speaks to a larger question that we got in on Twitter. Eric Durbin asked, how long would it take for the U.S. to set up a suitable infrastructure? We're talking about distribution and logistics to handle countrywide ethanol use.
Well, ironically, we have countrywide ethanol use now. Almost the whole country's gasoline supply is 10% ethanol. So we have set in place in the last 3-4 years the infrastructure to at least achieve 10% penetration. I think that we're probably going to achieve higher than that going into the future, not just with corn ethanol, but with other sources. If the technical and the economic uncertainties about or difficulties of converting cellulosic material into biofuels, I think we're going to see higher penetration over the next 10 years.
All right, we're going to go to Bob in Washington, Iowa. Hello, Bob. Welcome to Central Standard.
Yeah, thanks for the program and taking my call.
No problem.
I'm a pork producer, and we're an unrepresented portion of the ag sector in this discussion. We're relatively powerless politically. I mean, all of our reps jump on the corn bandwagon. And I, Professor Babcock, I have a lot of respect for your work. But where does this figure into the equation, the cost, the transfer of wealth from livestock producers, end users of corn? At some point, I mean, I've hung on. My wife's got a good job. That's what most people are doing. It's just hanging on in livestock. That cost is going to be transferred to the consumer, and it'll quit coming out of our pockets because we're going to be broke. And, you know, people just, they talk about it like it's an incidental. Oh, this has driven up the cost of feed. Well, believe me, when you're paying for that corn, it's not just an incidental. I mean, my cost of just, that's the single biggest expenditure for hog producers, and it's unreal.
So what about that unintended consequence?
Well, and the other thing is to compete with the government subsidizing our competitor. It's amazing. Think what, in your line of work, I can't think of an analogy, but the government, something you have to have, and the government subsidizes one of your competitors to buy that item from you, instead of you, and drive up your cost.
What do you say to that, Professor Babcock?
He's exactly right. But you got to remember the in the past, the reason why we've had ethanol is because we want high corn prices. It's succeeded in that. If one of our objectives is to raise the price of corn, we've succeeded. Now, we've got to remember that corn is used for livestock feed, and so that means we've raised the cost of producing hogs, eggs, milk, yogurt, meat, everything we eat, and it's a basic trade-off there.
Is that an opportunity cost that you expected?
Yes. When we first looked at ethanol, when corn was still cheap, we said the price of corn is going to go up about 75%. Who's going to get hurt? It's the livestock industry. Eventually, consumers are going to get hurt because eventually that higher livestock cost will be passed on to consumers, but it's little that economic notion that eventually the consumers are going to pay the cost and the price of pork and the price of meat and eggs and milk will go up to compensate farmers for the higher cost of feed. I'm sure the current livestock producers say that doesn't help me today, and they're exactly right. And the last point I want to make, I think he said it very eloquently, the government now is subsidizing a competitor to the U.S. livestock industry. And what the Congress is just ready to do is that even though corn prices are high, the government is stimulating demand for corn even more through that tax credit. So, in fact, he's got it on the money that the livestock sector is facing a strong competitor that does not have to adjust their production in response to high corn prices because the government's there backstopping their industry. So he's got it right on the money.
Professor, though, I mean, this does before ethanol, corn prices weren't sustainable for corn farmers, though. Isn't that right?
Hold that until we get back. We're going to take a brief break, and when we return, we're going to talk more about corn prices and food and how NASCAR is getting in on the ethanol action. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard, broadcasting on KCUR and Iowa Public Radio as part of a special partnership with Harvest Public Media. We'll be back in a minute to talk ethanol. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabulani LaFall. In the tank for today's show is ethanol. We're hosting a conversation today with the Midwestern Regional Reporting Initiative, Harvest Public Media. As part of this collaboration, we're simulcasting on Iowa Public Radio and welcoming listeners of Talk of Iowa into the conversation. In the studio live with Harvest Public Media is Frank Morris, and on the phone from Ames, Iowa is Professor Bruce Babcock of the Center for Agricultural and Rural Development at Iowa State. And now we're going to bring in Kathleen Masterson from Iowa Public Radio. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Hi.
Now, listeners, we'll hear your report. We've been talking corn prices and the trifecta of protection, subsidies, tariffs, and the mandate. What will you be talking about in your report?
Yeah, a lot of actually what just came in with that last caller, really how the ethanol industry and its growth over the last 5 years has had an effect on livestock producers that will trickle down to consumers in the way of food, mostly meat, eggs, dairy, things that rely on corn as their main input cost.
So where are we what are we seeing in the price of feed corn, and what's the main complaint, like the hog farmer from Iowa mentioned?
Yeah, that is the main complaint. When corn goes up, that's the main feed, and it's been up even since June. I had one hog farmer quote me it up 37%, about $25 per hog. So it's been up a lot, and that also drives up other grain prices. When corn goes up, soy tends to go up, soybeans tend to go up. So a lot of the feed costs do go up, and that is their main complaint. As the caller said, it's not just that the costs have been up, it's that those costs are subsidized by the government. The government's putting a tariff on foreign ethanol and also paying gasoline blenders to use ethanol. So it's sort of an artificial demand for corn from the ethanol industry.
Similar to the corn subsidies, I guess. But how do these subsidies influence the price of ethanol on the spot market and beyond?
Well, they certainly make it easier fuel for gasoline blenders to turn to when oil prices are high. So when oil prices are high, you're going to see more ethanol used in gasoline, because by comparison, that'll look like an even better fuel when we're seeing high oil prices.
Are we already paying more for food because of ethanol? Have we seen those effects already?
We have. Since the mandate went in place in 2005, there's been a steady increase in the cost of corn. Some dips and valleys, but a fairly steady increase in the cost of grains. And actually, Professor Babcock studies have calculated about a 1.5% overall increase and much higher increase in the meat industry.
So if you're in Mr. Babcock, you can chime in on this too, Professor Babcock. If you're a corn farmer, how do you determine who you're selling to and what portion of your crop will go to ethanol or feed or the like?
You don't. You just sell it to your elevator, and then they sell it. The market for corn, how corn is marketed, is so efficient that it's a world market for corn. And so really there's a world price of corn. And so who gets the corn, it's out there for the highest bidder, whoever wants it. We have open borders and trade, so if China wants it, they could come in and buy the corn. The ethanol industry can buy it or the livestock. So they're all competing against each other. The thing about the ethanol industry, though, in the United States, is that they have a mandate, and a mandate means that even if the price of corn keeps rising, the ethanol industry won't wean itself from corn, because they can pass that cost of the higher corn prices straight on to the oil companies, who then would pass it on to fuel users, all of us that fill up at our tank. So in some sense, all the bidders on corn have to bid against each other, but one bidder has the government behind them, which is the U.S. government through their mandates and their tax credits. They have the help of the government.
Now, Kathleen, talk about that three-headed monster, so to speak, that trifecta of protections around ethanol: subsidies, tariffs, and a production mandate. What are the origins of this? What did you find out?
Yeah, well, it mostly originates in really trying to boost our use of renewable fuels here. And I know you talked a lot about energy efficiency earlier. That debate aside, the government was really trying to say, we've got to make a homegrown fuel. So that was where the mandate originated, and then to further encourage use of these fuels, the tariff came in and the tax credit came in. So, you know, a lot of people would argue that's been helpful. It certainly boosted the industry, brought it to its current size. It currently consumes ethanol industry consumes about one-third of the corn crop in the U.S. So it's certainly a big competitor, as Professor Babcock mentioned. And it's really grown. The question now becomes, do we want to continue to subsidize fuel over food? And a lot of economists are saying, no, we've really grown this to the point where it should be able to stand on its own two feet.
Is there any effort, or do you, Professor Babcock, do you envision any effort to revisit the mandate, you know, maybe in the next presidential election? I don't know if that's something that can be adjusted, but I wonder, given the unpopularity, the broad unpopularity of ethanol, if that might not be an issue.
I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is I don't think ethanol is that unpopular. I think that the subsidies are unpopular. I don't think very much focus has been on the mandate per se. It's mm-hmm. been more on the import tariff and the subsidy because, in fact, the mandate came about in at the height of the Iraq War when President Bush pushed these mandates as a way for us to move away from fossil fuels, from petroleum, from sending money to the Middle East. And so that resonated dramatically with voters and with other politicians. So the reason why we have these mandates in place is, in fact, we thought that the Washington, anyway, thought that we should show the American people that we're trying to avoid having to go to war in the Middle East in order, some people think, to protect oil supplies. So I think that the mandate has quite a bit more political support than does the other measures.
You're listening to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. We've been talking ethanol today with Kathleen Masterson of Harvest Public Media, Frank Morris of Harvest Public Media, and Professor Bruce Babcock of the Center for Agricultural and Rural Development at Iowa State University. Now, Professor Babcock, there's a cost to every source of energy, whether you're talking about foreign oil or electric cars that still rely on the power grid, and even solar panels, I guess, will to some degree end up in a landfill at some point. You're saying the emissions associated with ethanol far outweigh all of the other externalized costs. What's being done to make ethanol greener?
Well, I think some people think that the emissions are the big external cost. Other people think that water quality, but, you know, personally, I think that you get a net reduction in emissions when you burn ethanol. So I don't think it really as a cost. I think that you're actually lowering greenhouse gas emissions relative to gasoline when you're burning ethanol, particularly if you're going to burn sugarcane ethanol. Sugarcane ethanol is green. Now, directly to your question of how do you make corn ethanol greener, there's lots of steps you can take. You could site livestock facilities right next to the ethanol plant so you don't have to dry the byproduct, the distiller's grains that come off the ethanol. That greatly increases the efficiency. You can also not use coal to fire the ethanol plant. You could use biomass instead. You can also, and the ethanol industry has been fantastic at increasing the energy efficiency of their plants. It takes far less energy to produce a gallon of ethanol today than it did 10 years ago. So the ethanol industry is actually becoming greener, driven by market economics, that they're trying to save money. And, of course, if you really wanted to become green, you would put a carbon tax on or adopt a global measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, because right now we don't tax or we put a zero value on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So, you know, I think that if we're really worried about greenhouse gas emissions, we should have that discussion. But the corn ethanol industry it's pretty well settled that they have a lot. They have become a lot more efficient over the last 10 years.
And what do you say to the arguments about soil erosion or the monoculture approach to say corn or all wheat or even all soybeans that are being used in some biofuel blends? It lends itself to environmental concerns, soil erosion being one of them. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I live right out here in the middle of Iowa. I'm in the middle of corn and soybean country. I moved here in 1990 before the ethanol industry was very big. All Iowa produced back then was corn and soybeans. All they produce today is corn and soybeans because those are the two most profitable crops. Ethanol has almost nothing to do with whether Iowa produces corn and soybeans, Illinois, Minnesota. I don't believe that is a big external cost.
It's got something to do with whether Kansas produces corn, though, Professor. And, you know, Kansas is producing a lot more corn than before, and it's Kansas farmers are using fossil water, water from an aquifer that filled up at the end of the last ice age to grow that corn.
That's right. But there's an adage of economics that if you have a problem, what you ought to do is address the problem directly with a policy rather than indirectly. And I would say that if Kansas has a problem with water, they should adopt water policies that address that directly rather than trying to go indirectly through trying to figure out what to do with the price of corn.
Kathleen Masterson of Harvest Public Media, what are your thoughts on this?
I think you mentioned the issue of erosion. I think one thing that we at least ought to point out is that corn is considered a pretty leaky crop, and a lot of nitrogen fertilizer is used on it. So water pollution is one consideration. In terms of expansion, it's pretty hard to say exactly how much expansion of corn is due to ethanol. So that's a number that's kind of tricky to pinpoint. But I think it certainly is, from an environmental perspective, there are certainly concerns mainly to do with water quality and water use.
Well, Kathleen, as we move forward, it's going to be interesting to hear your story on Morning Edition next week, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Now, Professor Babcock, continue with this discussion about soil erosion, because as Frank Morris, our news director and the supervisor of Harvest Public Media, mentioned, it's different in different locales.
That's right. And I think Kathleen hit the target right on in terms of environmental quality. In terms of corn, the big environmental problem with corn is leakage of nitrogen into local and Mississippi River water supplies. And so I think that it's the nitrogen aspect of corn production and the irrigation and the use of water in places that are water short. And I think that those two issues are probably of more importance than soil erosion. In fact, the crop that corn is replacing in a lot of places, soybeans, is more erosive than corn. So I think that if we're serious about water quality in an area, we should adopt policies that address water quality. Or if we're worried about water quantity, we should adopt policies that deal with water quantity. I think it's not appropriate to actually address issues those environmental issues indirectly through the price of corn.
We're going to go back to the phones. Jim in Spencer, Iowa. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, thank you. There's a lot of winners and losers whenever you create new programs like this, just like when the railroads were pushed across or the highways, people were displaced and there were winners and losers, and we'll still have that. But the thing I think that needs to be considered in all of this is that whenever we sell a product like corn or soybeans, we sell that overseas, we give up a lot more than people might understand, because all of that becomes a secondary byproduct that contributes to the topsoil. And we are shipping our topsoil overseas. When we make fuel from that, we actually have a humus that is left behind that we can reuse here. And I just didn't think that was something that anybody was actually considering in the process of.
Professor Babcock, do you want to chime in on that?
Well, he sounds more of an expert than me, but I guess what he's referring to in terms of the humus is the corn stover that gets back into the ground, and that's correct. But the ironic thing is, it seems like the low cost source of cellulosic material for expanded biofuel production is exactly that corn stover, and taking that off the land reduces the amount of carbon organic material that goes back into the soil. And so we have to be a little bit careful in terms of thinking that harvesting cellulosic material is going to solve all environmental problems.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR and live streaming on KCUR.org as part of a special collaboration with Iowa Public Radio and the listeners of Talk of Iowa. We'd like to welcome you, and thanks for joining us in the discussion about ethanol today. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Now, have you noticed a difference when using fuel that contains ethanol? Do you go out of your way to buy pure gas versus ethanol? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. We're also on Twitter. Tweet in using the hashtag HChat. Now, joining us now is Jessica Najunas, a reporter for Harvest Public Media, on the phone from KBIA in Columbia. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Good morning.
Now, you discovered some things about the use of ethanol in engines. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it wasn't KVIA or Harvard Public Media that discovered these things about ethanol. It's really the Department of Energy and independent consumer advocates groups like Edmunds.com and Consumer Reports. You know, it's interesting. The ethanol industry will say that there's no significant drop in fuel economy as we move from one grade of fuel to the other. You see a 1.7% drop in fuel economy from E10 to E15. It's fairly insignificant, but what they don't talk about is over time, how we move from E10 to E27, you're going to see a 10% drop in fuel economy. They're focusing on that incremental drop, and they're not focusing on the long term, which where you will see a fuel economy drop.
E27? What's
E27.
That?
E27. You're mentioning the different types of ethanol and grades of ethanol, E10, E15, E27. Tell us about these types. Tell us about these types.
E27 is where the ethanol is looking in the future. They're calling it their sweet spot where they can satisfy the federal fuel renewable fuel mandate. So they're not just going to stop with E15. They really would love it to have all cars on the road using some sort of ethanol-based fuel. E15 is just a notch in their journey. They're definitely not going to stop there.
Patrick in Merriam, Kansas writes in to ask, isn't it true that ethanol-blended fuels damage older cars? Why are there so many varieties of ethanol, and how do they affect our cars?
You know, Edmunds has some studies on that, too. And what they've found is that ethanol gets more of a pass when it comes to engine performance. Some cars that were built, you know, in the 1980s and the 1970s that are still on the road today, you may see some sort of engine performance issue with those cars. But if your car was built in 2001, Dan Edmunds from Edmunds.com says you won't see much of a difference. So we're also talking about small engines that you find in recreational vehicles and gardening equipment. Those studies are a little bit more controversial.
And certainly it's a case-by-case basis. We got an email from Roger in Creighton, Missouri, who says, and I quote, I was one of the first to buy gasohol the first day it was offered to the public at the Farmers Co-op in Holdrege, Nebraska. And since then, he has driven five cars well over 100,000 miles, and two of them well over 250,000 miles with no engine problems at all. When he first moved to Missouri, there were signs that said, no alcohol in our gas. And he says, and I quote, I couldn't believe they were actually advertising that they sold bad gas. So he's obviously a fan of ethanol or grain alcohol-based gas. Is there a noticeable difference in engine performance? Did you find that in your report, Jessica?
Edmunds.com will report, and other consumer advocate groups will report that you might see maybe better acceleration and perhaps more horsepower. NASCAR, that's one of the things they're touting in their switch to E15, that their drivers will get more horsepower. What they don't say is that there is a cap on how much power they can put in their cars or ask from their cars. They're not going to race around the track and put their drivers in any sort of danger. There's definitely a cap. So that horsepower is there, but it may not benefit the NASCAR drivers that will be using E15 in the future.
Now, NASCAR is not only touting ethanol, but sort of writing a litmus test for ethanol usage. What was their big announcement?
Their big announcement was that they're switching in February 2011 to E15. Up until now, they've been using Sunoco high-octane fuel. And now they're partnering with American agriculture, American farmers, and the American ethanol industry with their switch to E15.
What did they get from the ethanol industry to do that?
Sorry, say that again?
What did they get from the ethanol industry to make that change? Are they getting, you know, the ethanol industry subsidizing the fuel, or are they paying? Do you know what the deal is?
Yeah, it's a six-year contract with Growth Energy, which is sort of the mouthpiece for American ethanol in the country today. It's just like any other sponsorship, but they're not just sponsoring, let's say, a soft drink or one product with a brand name. They're sponsoring the entire industry, so it's a little bit different.
Do you know what the dollar figure is?
That is not something they've shared with me.
Yeah. Jessica, you talked with the NASCAR racer, Carl Edwards, the NASCAR driver out of Columbia, Missouri, actually. What are his thoughts as a driver on this new move?
You know, Carl is open to it. One of the things he mentioned to me is that it's so important to know about everything that goes on in your car as a driver. He, like you said, he grew up in Columbia. He's from Columbia, and he owns farmland here in the county. However, he says that he doesn't know much about ethanol, and he is getting most of his information about the product from NASCAR and from Growth Energy. So I suspect that most of his opinions will be shaped by the ethanol industry and from NASCAR.
Well, Jessica, we look forward to your story. It seems very interesting. You got the NASCAR engines revving, and they're talking about ethanol. It's going to be next week on Morning Edition. So we look forward to hearing that from you, and thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
All right, now we're going to go to an email. Keith writes in to say, the professor, I'm assuming he means you, Professor Babcock, the professor says the science is settled on the production of ethanol being a positive in the energy stream. The question is, Keith says, how much of a positive is it? 1%? 10%? He asks, if we are barely getting more out of it than we're putting in it to produce it, why is it worth all the trouble? Dr. Babcock, Professor Babcock?
Sure. So it depends on if, I guess he's referring to energy balance.
And right,
so,
right, and, exactly.
So it turns out that, in fact, the Berkeley professors, not usually known for being so pro-ethanol, came out in a science article that looked at the petroleum intensity and just looked at it in terms of how much petroleum are we taking to produce ethanol that replaces petroleum. And it was like a 5-to-1 or 4-to-1 benefit just from petroleum. Now, there's other energy sources in ethanol that need to be accounted for. So if you're just thinking about, okay, if people say simple-mindedly, oh, we're taking more petroleum and putting it into ethanol than we get back out of a replacement for petroleum from ethanol, that's even more wrong. So that has a big positive petroleum balance. And so we're getting a big positive there. We're getting less of a big positive in total energy that goes into producing from field to tailpipe of ethanol. But even there, Professor Kassman at University of Nebraska calculates that we get about a ratio of 1.5 units of energy out for every unit of energy we put in. So that's the kind of energy balance we're talking about.
50% increase.
By the way, Professor, Molly and Scott from Iowa called in to say that they heard you say Iowa is still just corn and soybeans. They're saying that's not exactly accurate. There are organic farmers and winemakers more and more in Iowa these days. So they just wanted to let you know that. But on another note, Alphonse writes in to say, if we as a country want to use ethanol as a gasoline additive, then we should drop the tariffs and taxes on sugarcane-based ethanol from Brazil and just have at it. What do you think of that?
You know, that's spoken like an economist. An economist would say, if we really want renewable fuel and we put our policy in place to have that mandate to make that happen, we shouldn't really care where that renewable fuel comes from. That is, we should meet those mandates at minimum cost. But that, of course, runs right into the ethanol industry that says, no, the renewable fuel we want is homegrown renewable fuel, not renewable fuel produced in Brazil. So I think that's from an economic perspective, you know, it doesn't matter if renewable fuel is your objective of policy, but if your objective of policy is to raise the corn price in the United States, then that importing sugarcane ethanol sure doesn't do that.
I'm going to go to John in KC. Hello, John. Welcome to Central Standard.
Well, good morning. First of all, best local NPR program in the United States. And
thank
now
you.
To the not really, truly,
thank
not
you.
To the actual point. acreage used for corn for ethanol production is affecting acreage used for all forms of beef production. And we don't have any room left to graze our cattle. Now, of course, the pork producer who called in earlier made an accurate point. It's affecting the cost of your beef at the store. But now we have non-stakeholders speculating on what was grassland we're turning into corn production, so acreage is being affected, and an artificial increase in agricultural real estate prices from a subsidized industry that, if it did work, spoken like the economist, would not require subsidies at all. And I appreciate you listening.
Thank you, sir. Professor Babcock, do you want to speak to how this is affecting ag real estate? Very briefly?
The high corn prices have led to high real estate prices. The price of land last year in Iowa went up 16%, was announced yesterday. So, in fact, he's right. And the of concern to some environmentalists, not just beef producers, is that expansion of cropland, when cropland becomes more expensive, goes over grasslands. And grassland is a good habitat for a lot of wildlife. Not not only beef cattle. And so I think he's correct. And I think that as a society, we need to think about what policies are in place if we're going to stimulate the demand for land and the demand for croplands. Maybe we should have some policies that offset that by keeping in place conservation programs or keeping in place programs that keep grassland out there. And I think that that's a discussion that is worth having.
Professor Babcock, really quickly, we're running short on time here. Is the triple protection structure, subsidies, tariffs, mandate, et cetera, here to stay?
No, I don't think it is. I think we're going to be evolving out of it because the mandates are going to be so powerfully strong moving forward as in terms of a demand stimulant that I don't think we're going to have that triple stimulant forever.
Well, thanks for that. And what we learned today is we've got a lot more to learn about ethanol in this brave new world of ours, but we also learned that an ongoing discussion about solutions will lead to more innovation and hopefully changes for the better in industry, food, and transportation for this great country and wonderful world of ours. I'd like to thank all of our guests for joining us in this discussion. Bruce Babcock of Iowa State, Frank Morris, KCUR News Director, Kathleen Masterson of Harvest Public Media, and Jessica Najunas also of Harvest Public Media. And a special thank goes out to all the loyal listeners of Iowa Public Radio for lending Central Standard your ears today. Talk of Iowa will be back tomorrow at its regular time. And speaking of Iowa Public Radio, we'd like to thank John All and Jeff Schmidt of IPR, and look for further collaborations between Central Standard and Harvest Public Media, special programming that cultivates stories on fuel, food, and farming from the ground up.